And this is one point of information which I have discovered since I wrote my Wall Street Journal piece. The PBS producers wanted to go to Hanoi. They wanted to be able to interview communist leaders for their recollections. And the Vietnamese communist leaders were at least reluctant initially and were only willing to allow PBS to go to Hanoi if they had somebody whom the Vietnamese themselves trusted to be in charge of the interviews and in charge of all the work that was done in Hanoi. And Martin Smith, who was an Englishman associated with independent television in Britain, who was one of the co-operatives in the co-producers of this series, was acceptable to Hanoi. Now, ITV, you may not know here in the United States, is independent television. Its documentary division is notorious in Britain for its activities in producing propaganda for communist regimes in the Third World, and in particular for the Vietnamese and Cambodian communist regimes. One of their most notorious operatives is a man named John Pilger, who I'm ashamed to say is, like myself, of Australian birth. He's a latter-day Wilfred Burchett, and he has produced straight Vietnamese communist propaganda under the sponsorship of ITV. Martin Smith went to Hanoi. He was quite clearly sympathetic to the communists, and if you see the three programs which he produced, you'll find an interesting distinction, say, as contrast with the two programs that Austin Hoyt produced. When Martin Smith interviewed communists in Hanoi, he did not identify them as communists. He simply gave their names. Now, if you look at the two programs Austin Hoyt produced, you will find that these people were identified as former communist or a member of such and such, which was, of course, the honest thing to do. Now, it seems to me that what this was all about is a reflection of the way in which certain individuals involved in the production of several episodes were working for the interests of the Vietnamese communists. And I was telephoned after my Wall Street Journal article by somebody who was involved in the production of the series, who congratulated me and then said, "I agree with your conclusions about the series. I'm afraid it was a mistake for us to ever get into bed with the Brits." I think that there is a reflection of the reality of the series, a reflection from somebody who was a producer, who admitted to me that what was going on was not very savory. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure for me to be here this morning. When I usually try to talk to people to try to set some background for the conflict in Vietnam, it takes a little time because to do it properly, we have to cover about 4,000 years of history. And we don't have time for that, so I will be capsulizing and summarizing and trying to relate some essential themes of Vietnamese culture, political culture, to the nature of the struggle, to the definition of nationalism, to the reason why the Vietnamese people have always opposed communism. But first, let me start briefly with a comment as to the origins of my own involvement in this matter. My father, in 1954-55, was first at the Geneva Conference and then the head of Southeast Asian Affairs. And Tom Corcoran, who's in the room, who was in Hanoi in those months, remembers him. And the essential decision for the Americans was whether or not to commit to the support of the regime in South Vietnam, the Republic of Vietnam. That decision involved breaking with the French, breaking with French colonialism. And the American decision was an honorable decision, and it was the decision that gave us the noble cause. We tragically lost sight of that, and that's part of the story I want to tell you. But the basis for that decision was a recognition that there was nationalism, something different from communism, that the Vietnamese people did not like the communists, that they had their own autonomous set of values which enabled them to create a government and a society which was strong, purposeful, and their own. Now, in my dad's case, a particular understanding of that came from Mr. Trung Van Do, who was the foreign minister for the regime in 1954 at Geneva, and spent a lot of time talking to Dad about particularly how the nationalist leaders had been murdered by the communists allied with the French in 1946. I'll mention that briefly, and I think Steve may have a few comments. In any case, The seminal document, which has been overlooked by most people, opponents and supporters of the war, was President Eisenhower's letter to Ngo-Dinh Diem of October 23, 1954. And this was where we broke with the French and said we would support Diem and the South Vietnamese to build their own kind of Vietnamese Vietnam. And the French despised us for it at the time and ever since. My dad wrote the letter. And the last sentence says, talking about, we will aid Diem as long as he met certain conditions, conditions of performance. And he had to have a strong government. Such a government would, I hope, be so responsive to the nationalist aspirations of its people, so enlightened in purpose and effective in performance, that it will be respected both at home and abroad, and, critical part, discourage any who might wish to impose a foreign ideology on your free people. Why, therefore, is nationalism, an understanding of Vietnamese nationalism, central to our understanding of the war? First, nationalism justifies and legitimates the American support and the American involvement. If nationalism is genuine, if the Vietnamese, as it were, are as Americans or French to the French, England to the English, Russians to Russia, then our aid to them as an allied state to another allied state cannot be cavaled. It is an honorable thing to go to the aid of a people who are under attack. What we have to do, therefore, is establish the basis for nationalism. Now, the victory of the anti-war movement, in my judgment, was to persuade the American people, first the media, the intellectuals, and ultimately, as we just heard, many in the Congress, that there was no such thing as nationalism in Vietnam. All we were dealing with was a bunch of lackeys of French colonialism, corrupt generals in Saigon, bar girls and prostitutes, peasants in their humble villages who only wanted peace and a good rainfall. Nothing could be farther from the truth. Secondly, why is nationalism important? If we can work as partners with Vietnamese nationalists and have their own internal strength blossom up, they can carry the weight of the fight themselves. The object in war, and we'll probably be hearing from Colonel Summers about this, is will. As Senator Symes just said, we lost because our will failed. Our will did not fail in the battlefields of South Vietnam. It did not fail in the air over North Vietnam. Our will failed in Congress. The will of our soldiers did not fail. The will of those of us in the pacification program did not fail. Though afterwards, when you're on the losing side of a war, you kind of try to sort of forget about that. But the will failed here. Now, why was that? It failed because a French theory of Vietnam was adopted by the American intellectuals starting in about 1965 and 66. This French theory was then used to discredit the policy of the American government, which had informed my father and had informed the decision to support the South Vietnamese. The French theory was that the Vietnamese are another version of the Chinese, you know, sort of a younger brother people kind of thing, and that since the communists basically had won in China as a result of a class conflict, it was inevitable that the communists would win in South Vietnam as a result of another class conflict. It was a war of the rich against the poor. There was no room for nationalism. And by the way, they picked up a second French theory, that Ho Chi Minh was a nationalist. Now, if you read the books written by the people who shaped the anti-war movement from 1965 to 1970, and that's very important because we're talking about, unlike the PBS series, accuracy in media. You will see in those books, by tracing out the footnotes, that this idea that Ho Chi Minh was a nationalist goes back to four Frenchmen, and only four. No more, not five, just four. Jean Saint-Denis, Paul Meus, Philippe de Villiers, and Jean Lacouture. And therein lies the tale. They were all, by the way, free French supporters of de Gaulle, generally socialists, who had gone out to Indochina or were sent out there at the end of World War II to reimpose French colonialism. Their strategy for reimposing French colonialism, and this is quite clear if you read various books, was to make a deal with Ho Chi Minh. Because Ho, as a communist, and this is in Paul Meus's book, in French it's been translated in English, you see, because only the communists could think as Westerners. I mean, the French were astounded. You go to Vietnam and you meet the Vietnamese. He or she doesn't even speak French. How can you converse with them? Communists, of course, were mostly educated in French schools and many of them in Paris. When Ho Chi Minh decided to move into the modern world, he went to France. He went to the West. He sold out his tradition, his nationalist tradition. Most everybody else who was politically involved in from 1905, 1911 in that part of Vietnam went to Japan. Why? The Japanese were Asians. And by the way, they had just sunk the Russian fleet. Some of you may remember. The East was rising again. Ho followed the French. All significant communist leaders were sons or grandsons of mandarins who had a French Western orientation. The French could deal with them. The French could not deal with the Dai Vieks, the VNQDD, the Vietnam Cooking Dang Party, the Hoa Hao or the Cao Dai. So we have had, if you will, a great misperception, a great lie perpetrated on the American people. Which misperception led to our defeat? We lost the war due to a lack of understanding. Now, let me just make one point in evidence. Some of you may have seen or may remember this book, The United States and Vietnam by George McTernan Cahan and John W. Lewis. This was the book that was the Bible for the teach-ins in 65 and 66. And some of you who participated or who remember, there were very few teach-ins or participants in teach-ins who supported or who argued for Vietnamese nationalism. The thesis of Cahan and Lewis, which is a very popular thesis, again coming from Jean Lacouture, and who is quoted in here, one of the four men, and also de Villiers, who's also quoted, was that the war in 1960 in South Vietnam was another kind of uprising of oppressed poor people against Ngo Dinh Diem, who was supporting the rich. And Cahan and Lewis say in here that there was no support from Hanoi, no leadership from Hanoi for this until September 1960. And it says here in a footnote, in none of the official statements of the Hanoi government or the Lao Dong Party is it possible to find earlier evidence for Hanoi's encouragement of militant tactics by the Southerners until this meeting of September 1960. All right, so therefore, the war in South Vietnam was a legitimate uprising of oppressed peasants. We, the Americans, going to the aid of Ngo Dinh Diem, were bad guys. The American people don't have a lot of will if you let them believe they're the bad guys. They'd rather get out. And that's what we're being told in El Salvador today. We're the bad guys. Now, let's see what Hanoi has to say about that very point. One of the nice things that has come out since the victory is that the people in Hanoi are terribly arrogant and are no longer concealing things. And in order to take credit for all their good work during the war, the Army of North Vietnam has published a book detailing the history, the Anti-U.S. Resistance War for National Salvation. And they talk about in May 1959, it's a year and a half before this famous meeting where Hanoi said to the Southerners, you want to rebel, you want to fight them, fight the Americans, your loyal Vietnamese will support you. In May 1959, the Party Central Committee in Hanoi held its 15th plenum, a meeting of the party, and it was decided in May 1959 by the party in Hanoi to conquer South Vietnam by force. That's the truth. What American students and intellectuals and journalists were told was not the truth, and it reflected, again, this French misperception. Oh, and by the way, Stanley Carnot is no exception. Carnot's book in the entire PBS series is infected as if with a cancer with this misperception. In 1945, when Ho Chi Minh emerges, theoretically, we are told by the series, as the great nationalist leader of Vietnam, he has perhaps, in my judgment, maybe 10,000 followers in Vietnam. We should ask Cu Ti about that. He knows more than I do. I'll double it, 20,000. I'll double it again. I'll give Ho Chi Minh 40,000 followers in Vietnam in August 1945, okay? There was another man by the name of Nguyen Phu Cho who founded a religion, a Hoa Hao religion. Mystical trance in 1939 on top of a mountain comes out. He's operating the Vietnamese nationalist cultural tradition of Buddhist belief in virtue, and he establishes this religion, the Hoa Hao. From 1939 to 1945, he gains followers. How many followers do you think Nguyen Phu Cho had in 1945? How many would think he had more than 40,000? He had 1.5 million, right? 1.5 million in 6 years. Not bad, not bad. He's not mentioned in the PBS series at all. And by the way, he was murdered and butchered. His body was cut into little pieces by the communists. Stanley Karnow gives Nguyen Phu Cho, a man who could mobilize 1.5 million Vietnamese, one paragraph on page 143 and gets it wrong. He says the Wahao religion was founded in 1919. Well, it was in 1939. And he also said it was a sort of a French armed sect. Very wrong. Why did our intellectuals go wrong? The only thing I can come up with is there was a certain kind of elite racism. Something I can come up with. There's another, actually I have a second reason too, which is an extended sociological analysis of the new class. Phenomenon in American society really since the 1950s. About 25% of our adult population are college educated middle class professionals, and they like power. And the political forces they have used to gain power for themselves has primarily been on the left side of the Democratic Party. You can analyze, just recently, the Hart-Mondale rivalry as Gary Hart and the yuppies and the yumpies, that's who I'm talking about, as the new class, as this new class seeking power for its own ends. And Mondale representing older forces of unions and the remains of political machines. But what I want to focus on among intellectuals, because it hasn't been talked about, and it needs to be talked about, and the PBS series failed in its opportunity to discuss this. Why is it that our intellectuals were so prepared to send Americans to die for white people in Europe, and very unprepared to support American sacrifices for yellow-skinned people in Asia? I'm told a story about William Fulbright and Lyndon Johnson. And when Fulbright realized that he couldn't talk Lyndon Johnson out of the war, he asked to see him in the White House. And it was just two of them. And Fulbright went through all his arguments as to why the Vietnam War was bad, it was a mistake, we shouldn't spend money, we shouldn't send our boys, it's just terrible. And Johnson just kept saying, you know, what? Be Afghanistan, I ain't got no choice. And finally Fulbright, in a moment of exasperation, leaned over and in a reverse Johnsonian tactic, put his hand on Johnson's knee and says, but Lynn, they're not our kind. Well, what kind are they? Well, the basic value of the Vietnamese, which informs their nationalism, is something called Phuc Duc. This is a rather unique Vietnamese concept. You can find analogs in China. It has origins, if you will, in Taoist beliefs, and it has other origins in Buddhist beliefs. It's basically, I translate it as merit virtue. What it really means is that if you're good, if you're a virtuous person, if you're selfless, then good things will happen to you in life. And if you're bad, if you kill people, if you're selfish, if you're greedy, if you're corrupt, bad things are going to happen to you. The interesting thing about it is that it goes from generation to generation. So my fate in this life is determined by the Phuc Duc of my father and mother and grandparents, but particularly on the female side. The mother in Vietnam has the primary responsibility for building up the Phuc Duc for the children. So Vietnam, while superficially a patriarchy, is quite centered on the role and the power of women, and has been for several thousand years. A major distinction from China, which is not picked up by any of the intellectual writings on the Vietnamese people. As a consequence of this value of Phuc Duc, you get two things, which means that the Vietnamese must oppose communism. They just can't live with communism, because from Phuc Duc you get one, individualism. Every individual has a fate. This is very Taoist and it's also Buddhist. The Vietnamese word for that is show, like our expression number. You know, your number's up. We each have a number. We each have our own individual fate. The party, the government, has no right to tell us what to do with our lives. That's why the Vietnamese flee. That's why they're boat people. And go talk to them. Why are they leaving Vietnam? Yeah, the conditions are terrible. It's their ancestral homeland of 4,000 years, but they're leaving. Why? Because they had their own individual karma. Maybe some of you saw Shogun, if you remember the ending. You know, the karma of the general was to become Shogun. Every individual has his or her own karma, and nobody can stand in their way, right? Not parents, not spouses, not children. I mean, it makes for interesting dynamics. The second thing that flows from Phuc Duc is a commitment to private property. Because the property you have, your material well-being in life, is something that is given to you by heaven. It's a result of your karma. If you have good Phuc Duc, you're going to have more money. You're not going to get sick. You're going to live to a ripe old age. You're going to have nice, respectful kids. You can't have a party coming along, as in the land reform program, for example, in North Vietnam and now in the South, and say, we're going to take that land away from you. Society didn't give me that land. That's my karma. That's my mother's good virtue. So built in between the communists and the Vietnamese people is a fundamental antagonism, which is never mentioned in the PBS series. Now, did the communists know about this? Absolutely, of course. So how could they seize power? Two tactics. One, front groups. The PBS series did not say, and you all should be very aware, that at no time did the Communist Party of Vietnam make as its central political demand on the Vietnamese people the imposition of communism. That was never the standard. The flag was waved, was always nationalism. They had to steal nationalism because they could not win on their own merits. The Vietnamese people wouldn't have them. The second thing they did was manipulate power. Now let me move to a more complicated part of Vietnamese nationalism. I've talked about this individualism. The way you organize Vietnamese politically, and here is the bane of the war from the American point of view and from the nationalist point of view, is you have to find a charismatic leader because it is very hard for Vietnamese to work together, especially nationalists. And it's not the kind of thing you're supposed to say in public, but the Vietnamese agree. And the problem has been from the beginning, and I'm sure Tom can remember in the 50s, who's the right leader for Vietnam, you know? It's not him, it's not him, it's not him, it's not him. But fortunately, I am here, right? And you ask Steve Morris, and he says, that guy Young, terrible, you know. Fortunately, I am here. Very difficult to get the Vietnamese to adhere together. Because the individualism, the Buddhist doctrine says you must follow somebody with virtue. Someone who has phuc duc. There's another word for it. It's called huy tín. A little more complicated. But basically, you're looking for someone of virtue. In 4,000 years of Vietnamese history, they have come up with four individuals. So when I'd be arguing with my Vietnamese friends and things like that, and they'd say, you know, you Americans, you're supporting the wrong guy. You shouldn't support Diem. You shouldn't support Thieu. You shouldn't support this guy. You got to have somebody. I say, like who? He says, ah, like Lê Lợi back in 1420, right? I'd say, great. Now, do you see any Lê Lợis on the horizon? No, no. We have to wait. We have to wait some more, right? And I would come back with the good old American pragmatic argument saying, fellas, that's a great idea, but in the interim, while we're waiting, how about making an alliance or you're working together? Well, the amazing thing to me is that, as the senator said, by 1972, the Nationalist Vietnamese had won the war. I mean, even without a Lê Lợi. I mean, they'd worked together. Wasn't very pretty, kind of messy, but they'd pulled it off. If you have someone who's got virtue, this right character, we then easy to get things done. If you don't have that, how do you organize Vietnamese? The other thing Vietnamese respond to is fate. There are two great determinants of individualism, our own virtue and fate. Okay? Now, fate can be defined, you can consult astrology, you can look at geomancy, you can read people's faces, that's called Dung Cho, and that tells you about fate. But fate is the manipulation of power. The concept of power is Tae, power over circumstance. And military power is sort of the raw essential. The communists won through the use of brutal force. They manipulated Tae, and so you got lots of Vietnamese. You can talk to them. You can talk to communists. You can talk to non-communists. You know, how come you're here? I didn't have a choice. They were the winning side. They had the guns. They walked in. They had the guns. What am I supposed to do? You know? Now, a quick review of how Ho Chi Minh succeeded. Was he a nationalist? Did he, as the PBS series said, use the love and affection of the Vietnamese people to propel his career? Nope. He appeared on the scene for the first time significantly in August 1954 as what? Does anybody know? The protege of the Americans. He had manipulated a rather naive American young major, 26-year-old Archimedes Patty in Kunming, into believing that he, Ho Chi Minh, was a real nationalist. And the reason he quoted the American Declaration of Independence was that he'd already told the Vietnamese people that I'm the American's boy. Now, the Vietnamese people, going back to the mid-1930s, liked the Americans because we'd promised to give independence from the Philippines. So we had great high status with the Vietnamese, going back very early. Ho emerges, and I'll bet if we ask Cu Chi, that he will confirm this, because he was there in those years. By appearing as the American boy, Ho got support from the Vietnamese people, and Bao Dai abdicated as emperor because he thought Ho was the American agent who would keep the French out. He did, however, send a telegram to Harry Truman saying, "Dear Mr. Truman, is Ho really, you know, your man? Is your Tay, is your power supporting Ho Chi Minh?" Cable was never delivered, never got an answer. Well, Ho comes in with the Americans, but he knows it's a lie and a fraud, so he drops that. The next thing he does is he bribes a Chinese warlord. The Chinese had sent some troops in to supervise North Vietnam, and there was something called the Week of Gold, the Gold Week, where all the rich families around Hanoi were asked to contribute their gold to do what? To buy guns to fight the French. Good line. Where did the gold go? Went into the pockets of this general, Liu Hang, I think his name was, right? And Ho, I've read this somewhere. When Liu Hang, the portly Chinese general, walks down the airplane at the Hanoi airport sometime in September 1945, Ho is out there with a pure gold opium pipe as just a little housewarming present. Ho's government in power also permitted the Chinese soldiers of Liu Hang to convert one Chinese dollar for one Vietnamese piaster. The only problem was the Chinese dollar was worthless, right? Chiang Kai-shek had printed so many, and the Vietnamese piaster was tied to the French piaster to silver. So the Vietnamese economy in the north was sort of crippled by this incredible inflation as the Chinese were taking all the silver out and moving it back up to China. A real patriot, Ho Chi Minh. Now, the Chinese then dropped Ho about December. He's got a problem now. The Americans aren't supporting him. The Chinese aren't supporting him. He's got to have the Tay, the power of somebody else. Who does he turn to? Anybody know? The French, right. Young lady in the middle there. He makes a deal with the dreaded enemy of his own people. The March 6 Accords, 1946. What do the March 6 Accords say? Ho and the Vietnamese communists say to the French army in Saigon, which has a mandate from de Gaulle to reconquer Vietnam, but the general doesn't have any troops, Leclerc, the French army gets to go back to North Vietnam and Central Vietnam, unopposed. French military troops go back to North Vietnam and Central Vietnam. Ho is then recognized as the only Vietnamese worthy of talking to. And that is the origin of this myth of Ho Chi Minh as a great nationalist leader. It comes out of an immoral and corrupt deal between Ho Chi Minh, the Western communist, and French colonialists, also Western. And if we understand that story and play it down, we can see that our cause in Vietnam was just. And we can also understand why the Vietnamese at this very moment are continuing the struggle inside South Vietnam. Thank you.
Before I speak, is the television ready to be run? Is there a technical... Okay, don't run it right this second. I just want to know it's available. Okay, fine.
We have a problem because the screen, unfortunately, is set too low. You may have to...
I see. Okay. I'll just raise my hand when I would like it to show. Okay, yeah, well, look, I'm in agreement with the general argument that Steve Young has presented, and I think we have to realize that the basic underlying foundation myth of the PBS series, which was the underlying myth of the anti-war movement, which is the underlying myth which sustains capitulation to communism in the Third World, is the proposition that communists aren't really communists. They're just nationalists, people fighting for social justice, who are doing things a little more quickly than we might want to do things. of course, the record of post-war Indochina suggests that they were doing things that we might not want to do anyway. But in any case, this is the basic underlying fundamental proposition which you really have to understand and you really have to deal with if you want to deal with the capitulationist lobby in this country or the capitulationist culture in this country. Now, what is basically wrong with it? The basic thing that is wrong with it is that it belies not only the actions, but even the statements, the doctrinal statements of the communists themselves. What do communists really think about nationalism? Everybody who's a communist is a person who has read the writings of Lenin and is an adherent of the basic texts and moral guidance which is provided in Lenin's writings. You only have to read really four basic works And that will explain to you everything about how communists think, what their basic values are. And the whole communist attitude to nationalism, which is found in the writings of Lenin, and which is repeated by every single communist since Lenin, including Ho Chi Minh, is that nationalism is an instrument whereby communists are able to seize power. It's a means whereby the world will become communist. Now why? Communists always used to think, or at least the followers of Marx used to think, that communism would take place, would come into being in the advanced industrial societies, countries like Western Europe and the United States, because in those countries you had the economic conditions which Marx foresaw as being the basis of communism, namely a large, well-organized industrial working class which had fundamental antagonisms towards the capitalist class. And only where capitalism had fully matured, said Marx, only where capitalism had fully developed would there be a seizure of power by the working class in order to create the real communism. Now, the problem for the Russian revolutionaries, of whom Lenin was the most important leader, was the fact that none of Marx's predictions ever came true. In fact, the working class were wedded to the system, and to his horror, he discovered that in World War I, the working class were patriotic. They supported their country. They didn't support the class struggle line, which Marxists were supposed to follow. And Lenin developed this interesting theory, which explained why there weren't going to be communist revolutions in advanced industrial capitalist societies. And the theory was that the working class had been bought off by colonialism, by imperialism. That the conditions for revolution had been forestalled by the capitalists. How? By the exploitation of the Third World. And by capitalists going outside their own country, exploiting the peasants in the underdeveloped countries, bringing the profits back home, providing conditions which made the condition of the working class in the West better, the working class lost their class consciousness. So the problem was, how do we destroy this nexus or this solidarity which we find in the Western world? How do we stop this situation where people in the Western world are not really interested in revolution? What we have to do is we have to cut off the lifeline of capitalism to the Third World. And if we cut off the lifeline of capitalism to what were then the colonial countries, then the problems of capitalism will turn back in on themselves. The working class will realize what a sham their society is, and the working class, now no longer having the payoff which was available to them by the exploitation of colonial countries, will then become revolutionary. So the doctrine, which the conclusion Lenin came to was, what we have to do is we have to support revolutionary movements in the colonial countries, in the underdeveloped countries, to destroy the power of the Western countries, to destroy the prosperity of the Western countries, which is based on colonial exploitation. So that means the communists have to support national liberation movements. A very important proposition. Now, this did not mean that they supported nationalism for its own sake. It was quite clearly a pragmatic commitment to destroying the basis of empire upon which Marxists believed that our prosperity and our social stability depended. Now, this meant that we communists would take a policy line within the colonial countries of supporting national liberation, as it was called. But there was a very important and fundamental condition upon that support. And that was that communists had to take the lead. They had to control the national liberation movement. Because one of the worst things that was possible was that if people in the Third World who were not communists were running the national liberation movement, all kinds of prospects for the seizure of power by communists in the Third World would not take place. All kinds of deals might be done with capitalism to restore its hegemony under another form, and so on and so forth. So therefore, the fundamental political basis for communist attitudes to nationalism was, we encourage nationalism in the Third World, but we must control it. Now, if you look at Ho Chi Minh's writings, You will find some of that statement back in the early 20s. There is a very important document in the French Communist Party newspaper, L'Humanité. I know it's been read by Jean Lacouture, who Steve Young refers to, because in his famous hagiography of Ho Chi Minh, he cites this reference to L'Humanité. But he doesn't cite the whole article. He cites the sections which support his thesis, and it doesn't cite the section where Ho Chi Minh says that nationalism is, if left uncontrolled in the Third World, is a dangerous phenomenon. Now that's there, and Jean Lacouture, to his eternal discredit, knows it was there but never cited it, because it's in fundamental conflict with the basic assumptions behind the anti-war activists, that these guys were not really manipulating nationalism, that they were really nationalists. Now, let me turn to second part of this whole thesis about why we didn't have to worry, why we don't have to worry about communist revolutions. And I'd like to see the first, if you can, excerpt from the series. There are some facts missing about this which would have been very interesting for the viewers to know about. But it illustrates what was motivating the OSS people, precursors of the CIA, who were operating in Indochina at the time. The fundamental beliefs that Ho Chi Minh wasn't really a real communist. He was just a nationalist. What is not in the series, which you ought to know, is that in May 1945, Archimedes L. Patti sent a request to higher officials within the OSS that he, on the basis of a meeting with this young Annamite, Ho Chi Minh, he felt the United States should throw its support behind Ho Chi Minh. And furthermore, the United States, in return for intelligence information about the Japanese, should provide arms to Ho Chi Minh. And in fact, in May 1945, Archimedes L. Patti authorized the airdrop of weapons to Ho Chi Minh inside North Vietnam, and those weapons were used, those American weapons, were the means whereby Ho Chi Minh seized power in Hanoi in August 1945. Without Archimedes Patti's decision to arm the communists in Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh could not have seized power. A very important historical point, which you will find almost nowhere. Secondly, after the communists seized power in August 1945, Ho Chi Minh, who had been playing a wonderful little game with Patti, invited him to come and appear at some public meetings he was organizing, including the meeting which was cited there, whereby historical accident that plane flew over and gave the Vietnamese the impression that the United States was supporting Ho Chi Minh. But what was really important was, during this period in August 1945, when there was a power vacuum in Vietnam, before the French came back, before the Chinese came in, before the British came in to take power from the Japanese, Ho Chi Minh had seized power with American arms, and he used the American intelligence operatives to appear on public platforms with him to give the Vietnamese people the impression that the United States was supporting the communists in Vietnam, that they had the blessing of the United States. And Patti fell for it hook, line, and sinker. And there is testimony from people who were there at the time that, and these were not communists, these were ordinary Vietnamese intellectuals and so on, that they were convinced by this. So there is a very important root of the conflict, the role of American intelligence, guided by the fundamental myth that these people were not communists. Interestingly enough, you'll find in the introduction to Major Patti's memoirs called Why Vietnam, he gives thanks to four people. Some of you won't know the names. D. Gareth Porter is one of them. Some of you do know the name. Author of the thesis that there was no bloodbath in Vietnam in 54, and also author of the proposition which was repeated in congressional testimony that there was no massacre going on in Cambodia in the post-75 era. That's one of the people Paddy gives credit to as one of his friends. There are several others, and another is a man named David Truong, who at the time Mr. Paddy served those words had been indicted for espionage on behalf of Hanoi and is now serving time in prison for passing on United States government secrets to the Vietnamese ambassador to the United Nations. So Mr. Paddy is a credible source. I don't believe that Paddy was working for the other side. I don't believe he's an agent of influence, because no real agent of influence would identify such friends. I think Mr. Paddy is an example of what Lenin called the useful idiot. He was extremely useful and extremely idiotic. But I'm afraid that the people of Indochina have paid the price for his idiocy. This leads me to the third proposition, which is connected with the flaws of the series and the inability of them to come to terms with the nature of communism. And that is the downplaying of the role of violence in the communist revolution. Again, to turn to this event, the August Revolution. How many of you know that in August 1945, 10,000 people were assassinated by the communists in North Vietnam and in the South? If they had not carried out these assassinations, they would not have been able to maintain their power. This fact does not appear in the PBS series. It can be found in a number of places, and if you want citations, I can give them to you later. Steve Young has referred to the massacre of the Hua Hao, who, as he pointed out, had 1.5 million followers. One might also add the Cao Dai, another religious group, which had more than 2 million followers in South Vietnam. And a third group, which has been one of the most misunderstood and misrepresented in the history of Vietnam, are the Catholics, the Northern Catholics. Most of you remember, if you followed the history of Vietnam somewhat, that the fact in 1955, about 900,000 people fled from North Vietnam to South Vietnam. And most of them, majority of them, were Catholics. And the myth which became part of a fundamental assumption behind the anti-war movement, which informs the series, is again that they fled, one, because they were Catholics, and Catholics, as you know, have reactionary attitudes to communism. Number two, they'd collaborated with the French, and therefore that they feared reprisals, which is explicitly stated in there, because of their association with the French. And three, that they fled south because of a CIA propaganda campaign, which is also stated in the beginning of the third episode of this series. I should point out that Ed Lansdale's interviews were scandalously cut in such a way that he appeared to be supporting this proposition. Ed Lansdale did play a role with American intelligence in encouraging the flight, but he did not create their anti-communism by lies. The fact of the matter, and the important fact in the history of Vietnamese Catholicism, is that the Vietnamese Catholics were originally very anti-French. They had fought in an alliance with the communist-controlled Viet Minh against the French. But in 1950, after Soviet and communist international policy changed, particularly towards Catholics, Ho Chi Minh's army launched a military attack upon the Catholic communities, who were their allies, in order to crush their military power. Because Ho Chi Minh, as a communist, could not accept the existence of an independent political military force in his country. And it was that act of repression by Ho Chi Minh which turned the Catholics from primarily anti-colonialists to primarily anti-communists. And that is the real reason why Catholics fled to South Vietnam. They had real reason to fear what the communists would do to them. Again, this important historical fact does not appear in the series because, once again, it contradicts the fundamental thesis which is they're trying to present. And my final example of the downplaying of violence is, of course, the description of the so-called land reform campaign. We're very fortunate to have here in the audience Mr. Hoang Van Chi, a Vietnamese nationalist, an authentic nationalist, who wrote a very important book back in the 60s called From Colonialism to Communism, where he outlined in great detail the communist land reform terror. And I believe he's those of us who've been lucky enough to read his book have learnt a great deal about not only about the Vietnamese communists, but the psychology of communism in general, and the role of violence in an attempt to destroy the basic institutions and fabric of society. Now, in the PBS series, you find the official Hanoi Party historian account of the land reform. They, in fact, use Polish film, and they describe the land reform campaign as a mistake, that there was some spontaneous violence on the part of the masses against landlords, which got out of hand. And then, eventually, the benign leadership of the communists reigned them all.